From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Melt the media snow job. That's what picketers will be saying outside newspaper offices in five cities on Monday.
We'll be picketing outside the offices of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, trying to focus attention on the media's 12-year suppression of the Contra cocaine link.
And we step away from the heat of the debate on Medicare to speak with a man who was there at its formation.
Basically, since 1968, Republican presidencies until Clinton in 92 meant that Medicare reform fell victim to either greater aspirations for universal health insurance, 1974, 1993, or has fallen victim to what you might call budget deficit politics. And so what people need to learn now, they need to discover why it was that Medicare was so important in the first place. And they need also, it seems to me, to discover the difference between supporting the program of Medicare and being committed to a particular level of expenditure for Medicare.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. American Airlines canceled most of its Friday night overseas flights today in the face of a looming strike deadline, as President Clinton urged the nation's second-largest carrier and its pilots' union to use mediation to resolve a dispute that he said has huge implications for our country. With a strike deadline set for 12:01 a.m. on Saturday and widespread disruptions in travel plans already apparent, pressure has intensified on the parties. Clinton said he's following the matter very closely and ordered his administration to study the potential economic disruptions of a strike, a first step toward any presidential intervention. Airline and union negotiators have continued to meet throughout the day after the pilots rejected management's latest pay offer. An American spokesperson said the airline had canceled its overseas flights for Friday night. A strike would cancel 2,200 flights by American on Saturday, affecting as many as 220,000 passengers. Under the Railway Labor Act, Clinton could intervene to name a three-member presidential emergency panel to recommend a non-binding resolution of the dispute if the mediation board found that the strike threatened a region's central transportation system and recommended intervention. In a last-minute effort to avoid a major breach with the United States that could threaten the future of the World Trade Organization, Europe has postponed its legal challenge to American sanctions against companies doing business in Cuba. European officials said that in the hope of reaching a compromise, they reluctantly asked the organization, the two-year-old arbiter of international trade disputes, to delay for a week the naming of a panel of judges to rule on the validity of the Helms-Burton Act, the American law that imposes sanctions on non-American companies doing business with the Castro government. Europe calls the act an illegal effort to force Europe, Canada, and Mexico to join the American effort to isolate Castro. Republican congressional leaders are recommitting themselves to doing away with affirmative action. At a Washington dinner last night, House Speaker Newt Gingrich called the practice affirmative racism and promised an all-out effort to end racial preferences. The dinner honored Ward Connerly, the African-American man who steered California's anti-affirmative action initiative to victory. Connerly told the crowd that ending race-based preferences is the only way to have a unified America. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that African-American males voted in much higher numbers last fall than they did in 1992, an increase of 1.7 million votes at the same time that other demographic categories showed declines. The trend attributed to the Democratic ticket's appeal and the Million Man March is causing politicians to shift strategies. And the House voted 217 to 211 for a constitutional amendment limiting members of Congress to 12 years in office, but the total was 69 votes shy of the necessary two-thirds majority. The shortfall was 6 votes larger than last year's House vote on the issue. This news from Mississippi. Governor Kirk Fortas signed a law banning homosexual marriages in Mississippi, denouncing same-sex relationships as perverse. He said, as Mississippi became the 17th state in a year to outlaw such marriages, for too long in this freedom-loving land, cultural subversives have engaged in trench warfare on traditional family values. The abortion pill, RU486, could hit the U.S. market by the end of the year now that a lawsuit holding up its introduction has been settled. The Population Council of New York announced yesterday it had reached an accord with San Diego-based Neogen investors. The council had sought to oust Neogen's owner, Joseph Pike, from the project. The council said Pike's criminal past, he is a disbarred lawyer accused of forgery, would scare away potential investors. Neogen had been licensed by the council to manufacture and distribute RU486. The U.S. rights could be worth $100 million annually. Was the Chinese government involved in Democratic Party fundraising? The Washington Post says the Justice Department is looking at evidence that representatives of Beijing sought to direct contributions from foreign sources to the Democratic National Committee before the 1996 election. The paper attributes its information to sources familiar with the inquiry. The sources do not provide details about the scope of the evidence uncovered so far or what foreign contributions might have been involved, but the Post quotes its sources as saying the new evidence is serious, and it says some of the evidence was obtained through electronic eavesdropping by federal agencies. A Chinese embassy spokesman denies that China was involved in improper fundraising. A woman has filed a lawsuit contending she was exposed to public contempt and ridicule by a radio talk show host's comment that she had an abortion after an affair with Bob Dole in the early 1970s. Phyllis Wells Smith of Overland Park, Kansas, sued Bonneville International Corporation, owner of KMBZ Radio. Her lawsuit claims that in a September 26 broadcast of the Friendly Fire talk show, host Steve Glorioso said Dole had an affair with a woman named Phyllis Wells in the early 70s. The lawsuit said the remark came as Glorioso, a liberal commentator and publisher of a local alternative weekly, The New Times, was discussing Dole, the 1996 Republican presidential nominee and former Kansas senator. A lawyer for Wells said his client and Dole did have a public relationship in the early 70s when they were both single, so he said there's no secret about that. They dated several times and appeared at political rallies together. He said she did not become pregnant by Dole. And Honduras yesterday was shaken by a hospital worker strike, and army troops patrolled main cities after five U.S. food outlets were damaged by explosions overnight. Five explosive devices were set off late Tuesday in the northern city of San Pedro Sula outside outlets of Burger King, Pizza Hut, McDonald's, Wendy's, and Fridays. The blast caused damage to the restaurants, but there were no casualties. Some 14,000 public health workers virtually paralyzed hospitals, launching an indefinite strike against what they said was an insufficient government pay offer. And you're listening to Democracy Now! When the San Jose Mercury News last year ran an expose linking the CIA Contra Army in Nicaragua and crack cocaine trafficking in the United States, the mainstream media studiously ignored the revelations. But when the Dark Alliance series by reporter Gary Webb sparked grassroots outrage and sharp attacks on the CIA for, at a minimum, sanctioning illegal narcotics trafficking, the major newspapers were forced to pay attention. However, the LA Times, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, among others, all published stories downplaying the story or attacking the San Jose Mercury News. Now, community activists and media watch groups are organizing against both the media and the CIA with two major actions next week. Joining us to discuss the press reaction to the San Jose Mercury News stories and the mobilization next week are Steve Rendell, a senior analyst at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, otherwise known as FAIR, which is a media watch group here in New York City. And we're also joined by Joe Madison, a civil rights activist who hosts a radio talk show in Washington, D.C. He's leading a demonstration a week from Saturday, that's February 22nd, at Los Angeles City Hall, calling for full disclosure on the role of the CIA in drug trafficking and the dismantling of the agency. Well, Steve, why don't we begin with you? FAIR is helping to organize demonstrations at offices of the LA Times, the New York Times, and the Washington Post in five cities nationwide on Monday. Tell us why you're focusing on newspapers.
Well, what we want to do is call attention to the fact that these three papers, the establishment media, these three elite papers, have been suppressing the story of a Contra cocaine link for the past 12 years. And I'd like to do a little thumbnail sketch of that story. Shall I do that now? Well, back in late 1985, the first national story about a Contra cocaine link made the national news. That was written by Robert Perry and Brian Barger for the Associated Press. What followed that story was a withering political assault by the Reagan administration, by the White House, on the AP, and on these two journalists, which basically drummed Robert Perry and Brian Barger out of AP. Huh. The political pressure put by the White House put the press on notice that any sort of deviation from the official line on Central America was going to be punished. What followed that was very interesting. In 1987, a senior Time magazine writer, Lawrence Zuckerman, came to FAIR anonymously and told us of a story that he had researched and prepared about an extensive story about Contra cocaine links.
Yeah, about Contra cocaine links. That was in
1987, and he took that story to his editors, and his editors told him flat out, they said, we have an institutional bias in favor of the Contras. If this was a story about Sandinista drug involvement, we'd run it.
It was flat out direct.
This writer, Lawrence Zuckerman, came to us originally anonymously. Since that time, he's released his name and is happy to be associated with that story. In 1989, of course, I think it's important to point out that the Kerry Committee, the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee.
John Kerry
from Massachusetts. His commission concluded that in looking into the Contra cocaine link, they said, quote, on the basis of this evidence, it is clear that individuals who provided support for the Contras were involved in drug trafficking. The supply network of the Contras was used by drug trafficking organizations, and elements of the Contras themselves knowingly received financial and material assistance from drug traffickers. In each case, one or another agency of the U.S. government had information regarding the involvement while it was happening or immediately thereafter. The Washington Post has admitted in an editorial since then that this story was not, that this committee report was not given near the attention that it needed. When FAIR's editor, the editor of Extra, FAIR's magazine, Jim Noricus, was working at In These Times in 1989, he called Keith Schneider at the New York Times and asked why the tiny little story on this issue was buried in the back of the newspaper. Schneider said, because this is a story that could topple a republic. So what we view Gary Webb's series in the San Jose Mercury News, we view that as the latest advance in a story 12 years old that has been suppressed by the mainstream media. That's why we're going out. We're going out to challenge the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times, challenge them on their record of journalistic cowardice, and to try to attempt to focus attention on that cowardice and try to push them to, rather than turning around and attempting to kill the messenger, Gary Webb in the San Jose Mercury News, to advance the story.
Well, I'm going to come back to you in a minute and ask you specifically what these three papers have been saying. I mean, we have dealt with this issue for a while, since Gary Webb has come out with the series. But I want to talk about what each of them has specifically said about Gary Webb. But before we do that, I want to ask Joe Madison about your event that you're going to be holding at Los Angeles City Hall, which is going to be two Saturdays from now. Now, you're not specifically focusing on the media. You're targeting the Central Intelligence Agency itself.
Absolutely right. Actually, there will be two events. I am very proud to join with FAIR to chair the demonstration that will take place on February 17th in front of the Washington Post at 4:30 p.m. on the same day. Then we will move over to out to Los Angeles. There are approximately about 160 organizations that have come together. We anticipate literally thousands of people who will meet at City Hall, march to the Justice Department, and even on the 22nd to the Los Angeles Times. If you think that the establishment newspapers have suppressed the truth, you can imagine what the United States government has done. Dick Gregory and I, for the last 6 months, have been involved in direct action against the CIA and the DEA. We were arrested in front of the gate of the CIA because Gary Webb's story actually stops at the gate of the CIA. We then were arrested in front of the DEA because there's a very brave former DEA agent that no one seems to want to talk to in the establishment newspapers, and that's a former DE agent named Sully Castillo. Sully Castillo spent years in Central America and actually documented through photographs, reports to the DEA about the loading of drugs onto airplanes that were headed to the United States to be sold. He has these photographs. He had submitted these documents. They are on file in the DEA. He has confirmation numbers. And with the hearings that were recently held this past fall by Senator Specter, Sully Castillo, on the ground, a former agent of the United States government, was never called to testify. And so we have to deal with this on several fronts. Stephen is right. I mean, the suppression and also outright attacks on the African-American community have been blatant. There was
I just wanted to interrupt, Joe, for a second, just to say that Sully Castillo himself, the DEA agent who went with you over to the DEA, I was covering it that day, although he didn't get arrested, you did,
right,
demanding information. He possibly faces indictment himself. Is that right?
Well, I understand that. That's some recent news. I know that they are investigating him at this point in time, and I guess where
they're putting out this information.
Yeah, where there is an investigation, there may be a potential indictment. But again, this is what is happening in order to keep this this story down. And what I was going to point out is that Sully Castillo is a very brave individual. He has a tremendous record. I mean, an outstanding record in the DEA in New York City as well as in Central America. So this is not some wild cowboy, some rogue agent that was acting independently. He was quite literally doing his job and was told by officials in high places to stop the investigation because it involved individuals from the White House on down. And don't even let me get started with the diaries of the diary of Oliver North, where there are several entries that, once again, the mainstream media refuses to honestly deal with, talking about drug shipments, arms being bought with drug money. And these are entries in Oliver North's own handwriting. I've debated Oliver North on a couple of occasions. He doesn't deny these entries, but he attempts to try to explain them away. But I just wanted to make one final point, and that is the attack on the African-American community. In both the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times, and Fair did a magnificent job in analyzing these attacks on the black community, suggesting that somehow we in the African-American community are predisposed to conspiracy theories. It was outright racist. It was an attempt to discredit those of us like Maxine Waters, Dick Gregory, myself, and others who have spoken out and taken a stand on this issue. There is no empirical evidence that suggests that African Americans in this country are any more predisposed to conspiracy theories than any other Americans. I know white Americans who think Elvis Presley is still alive, but yet we do not see the type of journalistic attack on those individuals as we saw in the Washington Post and the L.A. Times.
Steve
Rendell,
you wanted to get a word
That's why it's so important. I think Joe's making a great point. We had a sidebar in our piece in Extra Magazine called That Delusional Mindset, which talked about black paranoia and how blacks had this unreasonable paranoia about the Contra cocaine link. That's why it's so important that people from all communities come out to these demonstrations. I want to clarify one thing. Joe is actually in our coalition. Joe will be, if I could do a quick roundup of the five cities.
Well, before you do that, we have to break. And when we come back, you can talk about that. Again, we're talking to Steve Rendell. Steve is a senior analyst at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting here in New York City, Media Watch Group, that is helping to organize demonstrations in five cities. And we're joined by Joe Madison, civil rights activist who hosts a radio talk show in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in just about 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, and we're talking about a bunch of protests that are going to be happening starting next Monday, and Monday in five cities, and then next Saturday, a protest outside Los Angeles City Hall. We're joined by Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and we're joined by Joe Madison, a civil rights activist and talk show host who has really been leading a crusade around the issue of CIA connection to the Contras, CIA connection particularly to crack cocaine brought into this country by the Contras, and he's been leading this since Gary Webb's series came out in the San Jose Mercury News months ago. Steve, you were just talking about the protests in the five cities.
Yes, this coming Monday, President's Day holiday, February 17th, 4 days from now, the media demonstration will be happening in five cities, and I'd like to give a quick rundown. In Washington, D.C., things will start off with a press conference in the morning at 10 o'clock at the J.W. Marriott. Participants will include Laura Flanders from FAIR, John Newman from the University of Maryland, a history professor, and Joe Madison, who's on the line with us. In Los Angeles, the participants will include Norman Solomon from a FAIR associate, Holly Ainbinder, FAIR's associate director, and Sweet Alice Harris, a community organizer in South Central Los Angeles. There they have something very interesting planned. They've got a snow machine donated from the set of a certain movie, and for the first time in the history of the LA Times, there will be snow in the streets outside. there'll be some other interesting street theater going on there too. And we really want to
stress. That's for snow
stress.
Job.
Yeah, and that's what's so important about this whole story is that the press has been able, because of institutional racism, to dismiss this story as part of the delusional mindset of the African American community. We need to get people from all communities out there and to show that everybody's concerned about this. Now, if I could go on, here in New York, the demonstration is at 12 noon in front of the New York Times. That will include also, in addition to Jeff Cohen and myself and Janine Jackson and Jim Narikas, also Bob Law from WWRL, the host of Night Talk on the Black Talk Radio Network. In Chicago, there will be a small demonstration. And in San Francisco, the Media Alliance looks like it's shaping up to for a very large demonstration there.
Huh. Yeah, Amy, if I can say something, the one thing about this issue, and let me make no mistake about this, it has united people. It's the one issue that has brought all of us together, black, white, brown, men, women, old, young. Even, do I dare say, the left and the right are coming together on this issue, and there are those who were formerly in the Reagan administration who can't deal with this. They are doing their best to try to drive wedges between African Americans and white Americans by saying that this is a get whitey campaign, that black people are trying to cast blame on white America. It's not working.
Joe, let me ask you something. A lot of people were surprised when Senator Arlen Specter, who is head of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, opened hearings into the whole issue. And the room was packed. The room was packed with hundreds of people, mainly African-American, from the Washington, D.C. community. I know you were there. Dick Gregory was there.
It was overflowing.
And others. Mm-hmm. It was, and even with such short notice, because a lot of people hadn't been informed.
That's right.
Then there was a second hearing, and there was some hope. Adolfo Calero was there, one of the Contras. He was testifying, and Eden Pastora as well. But right now, Arlen Specter is no longer the chair of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee. What is going to happen now? Will there be hearings?
I just met. I was on Capitol Hill yesterday meeting with Maxine Waters, who is planning in the next 2 or 3 weeks, because Congress will be going on recess, I believe, today for a week. There is a legislative agenda. Some very powerful legislation is going to be introduced by Maxine Waters once she returns. Elijah Cummings, the Democrat from Maryland's 7th District, is planning several activities. And as we speak this morning, Congressman John Conyers has a forum going on right now with some of the most prominent people in this whole issue, meeting and briefing staffers on Capitol Hill. Jack Blum, who was the chief investigator for the Church Committee and Senator Kerry's investigation, David Korn, the author of Blonde Ghost, Ted Shackley and the CIA Crusade, Al McCoy, who we all know, professor at the University of Wisconsin, who wrote The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Global Drug Trade. All of these individuals are on Capitol Hill today. So we are beginning to get this back into the on the center page. And the demonstration by FAIR in the 5 cities are extremely important, as well as the demonstration on the 22nd in Los Angeles.
Steve Rendell, have you gotten any interviews or appointments with officials at the New York Times, or the Los Angeles Times, or the Washington Post to discuss this?
No, they don't call us too often. But I'd like to stress that people have a right to expect that their media look after the public interest. The highest calling of journalism is that they take power's feet and hold them to the fire. And what we're not seeing that here. What we're seeing is a 12-year history of these elite media circling the wagons around the governmental elite. The larger that these news corporations get and the corporations that own the news get, the more they identify with that power elite. And what we're seeing here is a story of journalistic cowardice and a fact that the press identifies with that power. What we need to do is demand that they get back on the case of the public interest and that they challenge power.
And even in Washington, D.C., the Washington Post ombudsman wrote a very stinging column attacking her own newspaper for looking after the interest of official Washington agencies as opposed to the interest of the American people. I have talked to many journalists and interviewed them on my radio show. And I've asked them, what in the living daylights is going on? Well, the first thing that tends to come out of their mouth is it's journalistic jealousy. Little San Jose Mercury News, which is really not that little, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper, does a 16-month investigation. And one of the things that they did that really gives them tremendous credibility is that they put all the documents on the internet that they used to write their story. And what did the Washington Post do? What did the New York Times do and the LA Times do? They attacked the San Jose Mercury News, and they used as their sources unidentified individuals who worked for the CIA. At least the San Jose Mercury News had the journalistic decency to name their sources and then through the use of the Internet, placed it on their web page for all to read.
Steve Rendell.
Yes, I just wanted to point out that anybody interested in joining the demonstration in these five cities in New York, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, San Francisco, or Chicago can call the fair office to get information and contacts in any of those five cities. That number is 212-633-6700, extension 306. That's 212-633-6700, extension 306. Come help us melt the media snow job.
And Joe Madison, what about your protest in two Saturdays out in Los Angeles? Is there a contact number?
Yeah, well, the contact number you can reach me here in Washington at 301-587-4900, or in Los Angeles, 213-250-8083. Let me repeat, 213-250-8083. And please, all organizations, churches are coming on board, civic groups are coming on board, progressive groups are coming on board, black, white, Latino, you name it. This is an issue we will not let go away. Dick Greger and I have been on a hunger strike now. This is day 120, where we have vowed not to eat any solid food until the truth comes out. And we're getting closer and closer to the truth, but we must stop the suppression of this news and information that people need to read.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. I want to thank Steve Rendell of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting here in New York City, and also Joe Madison. It's nice to have you back again, civil rights activist who hosts a talk show in Washington, D.C. And I can say when I am in a cab in the middle of the day going over to the White House press briefing that I often will hear Joe right there every day talking about the CIA crack connection. Thanks so much for being with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're going to switch gears right now and talk about Medicare. Like many of the legacies of FDR's New Deal, as well as those of the Great Society programs of the 1960s, the federal program guaranteeing the elderly and the disabled access to medical care, otherwise known as Medicare, is under sharp political attack from conservative forces. A number of proposals are on the table in Congress, ranging from cutting Medicare spending, rolling back home health care, and making wealthier people pay more. Already, Congress and President Clinton agree that Medicare spending will be slashed by at least $140 billion over the next 6 years. Here to discuss some of the proposed changes to Medicare is Professor Ted Marmor. He's a professor of public policy at the Yale School of Management and author of The Politics of Medicare. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ted Marmor. And why don't we begin with you just laying out how you first got involved with the formation of Medicare?
Well, I was part of it in a limited way, two respects. First, I married a surgeon's daughter in early 1960s and had family arguments for 4 years before Medicare passed in 1965. And it was during that period of time that I vowed that I would write a book to settle these family quarrels. And in the course of finishing graduate school, finishing my PhD on another subject, I decided to write this book, and I interviewed all the major actors involved in the struggle over Medicare in the 1960s, which culminated after the election of Lyndon Johnson by a landslide in 64 in this overwhelming Democratic majority. And Medicare swished through, as did federal aid to education and a number of other bills. While interviewing both people in the Congress and the Senate, I also tried to get an interview with Wilbur Cohen, who was really the father of Medicare, if you can think about it, the co-parent, along with Bob Ball, the former commissioner of Social Security. Cohen had come to Washington in 1935 as a kid from the University of Wisconsin, following his own professor, Edwin Witte, who became the executive director of the Committee on Economic Security, the body that suggested the Social Security Act of that year. And I think Cohen recognized in me a counterpart to himself, so that when he read my draft of a long chapter on why Medicare had been so controversial, instead of talking about my chapter, he handed it to me, said there were comments on every page, and asked me whether I could go to work for him. And after an odd conversation, which isn't worth going into, I did. I came. I didn't conquer, but I stayed for the first summer and was there when Medicare began and wrote his speeches, one of which I still can remember now when I walked into a crowded room in a Washington ballroom, really, with about 1,500 nursing home operators who, when Mr. Cohen came in to deliver the speech I'd written for him, booed him. Now, this you have to understand. Medicare and Medicaid were going to be a boon for nursing home operators. But the ideological conflicts were so great that these people sacrificed, in a sense, their economic interests to their ideological purity and really treated him very roughly. And Cohen, I'll never forget as long as I live, he said, whatever our differences, we've got a program to run, and I'd like to talk to you about that. In the most calm way, he was a sort of impish man, but they called him Czar Cohen, and they got instead not the Tsarina, but they got a kind of old-style American social democrat committed to making the government work who'd never dream of talking about Medicare or Social Security the way we now talk about it.
Well, perhaps those are the very people that today would be saying we've got to cut, cut, cut. Can you explain how it is that Medicare got passed then, because it might help some people who are organizing to preserve it today?
Very simply, instead of trimming what it is that people wanted in health insurance in America by trimming back the benefits to nothing or doing them in a way that was unlikely to be sustainable, the reformers then said, well, we're never going to get national health insurance in one fell swoop. So let's start with an age group, and let's start with a big program, but not the whole program. So they advocated 60 days of hospital care. That's what Medicare was when it was proposed in 1961 by Kennedy and even before then. But when the electoral landslide took place and 2-1 Democratic majorities emerged in the House of Representatives, all of a sudden the conservative coalition of Southern Democrats and Republicans that had held this up was washed away. It's very rare in American politics that happens. When that happened, oddly enough, the former critics of Medicare, Wilbur Mills, expanded it to include Part B, the doctor's pay, in order to stop the reformers from coming back the next year and saying, you only did half the package. That, along with the Vietnam War, that expansion to build a fence around it, plus the erosion of public support through the Vietnam War, and then basically since 1968, Republican presidencies until Clinton in 92, meant that Medicare reform fell victim to either greater aspirations for universal health insurance, 1974, 1993, or has fallen victim of what you might call budget deficit politics. And so what people need to learn now, they need to discover why it was that Medicare was so important in the first place. And they need also, it seems to me, to discover the difference between supporting the program of Medicare and being committed to a particular level of expenditure for Medicare. I myself am an expenditure hawk on Medicare and a Medicare preservationist on all of its basic design features.
What do you mean, expenditure hawk?
I think we should be absolutely embracing the idea of reducing Medicare's projected expenditure. You need to know that CBO last year, the Congressional Budget Office, anticipated in their forecasts something like 10% per year increases in Medicare expenditures. If you push any program up at 10% per year when incomes are rising at 2 and 3% per year in real terms, you produce catastrophe down the line, and I'm not for it. I think there's no reason to believe that Medicare requires anything like those kinds of expenditure increases. I think, for example, you ought to say, we have the most expensive program for the elderly per capita in the world. We ought to ask ourselves, how can we adjust that program over time to our increased income and that alone, but to improve the program within that budget? That's what I mean by expenditure hawk. So you say $138 billion doesn't make one bit of sweat come to my brow. What counts is how do you get that $138 billion of reductions in what was expected to be spent.
Okay, well, President Clinton is proposing cutting back on Part B, and I'd actually like you to explain Part A and Part B, but the payments to doctors. And also, there is being introduced this idea that wealthier people should have to pay more, What do you think about this?
This is a wonderful example of a good idea in tandem with a terrible idea. The notion that you should control the expected expenditures by reducing what you pay those who provide the care seems to me exactly right. Medicare's expenditures on one side of the accounting ledger must equal the income of medical care providers on the other side, right? It's an accounting identity. X for E for expenditure equals average prices times average volume. And anybody who works with, who knows anything about the way the world works, know that has to be the case. Now, most of the providers, the insurance plans and the HMOs and hospitals are telling you, oh, my God, we're going to be forced to deny medical care to people. We can't possibly do that without. Well, this is the sort of complaint that anybody would make who didn't want their income reduced. But it's a very big difference between not wanting your income reduced and saying that you won't give decent care. That's point one. Point two, if I thought that we were paying our hospitals and our doctors, particularly our surgeons and our specialists and our large hospitals, amounts of money which were at the very border of impossibility to continue, I'd feel more sympathetic. That is, I think, nonsense. So given that we spend more per capita, I think we need to do two things. Spend less for particular items. That doesn't mean all the fees are organized in a sensible way. I don't think they are. I think that there's a fair amount of cognitive care, caring for people by speaking to them, by checking them, by reassuring them, by ruling out things rather than doing things to them, cutting them and examining them with diagnostic materials. There's a lot, but that's an area where the payers and the providers can get together and try to figure out what makes more sense. But a budget reduction of expected outlays, absolutely. We've shied away from the idea of saying, we're going to spend so much on Medicare next year. We spend so much. That says you providers have got to do things with that make sense to you professionally, exactly the same way I'm dealt with at Yale University.
Professor Ted Marmer, we have to break. Professor Marmer is a professor of public policy at the Yale School of Management and author of The Politics of Medicare. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Now, I'm Amy Goodman, and we're continuing with Professor Ted Marmer of Public Policy at the Yale School of Management and author of the book, The Politics of Medicare. You were talking about why you don't think it's a good idea that the rich should be taxed more for Medicare.
The reason I said that the second idea was such a terrible idea, I mean, I think it's it is a wonderful example of Washington technobabble. Let me give you the part A is the hospital insurance plan. For Medicare. It's really exactly identical. It's identical in every respect to the Blue Cross plans of the 1950s. You go into the hospital, it turns out you have a deductible of one day of hospital care, and basically your service benefits are provided. You're covered mm-hmm. for the service. Very important. There's some limits, but they're so small that they really only add up to a 60 days of hospital care and a lifetime reserve means that for all practical purposes, America's elderly and disabled and those with renal failure are covered for hospital care. The doctor's part, though, Part B, is paid for very differently. That's not mandatory. It's not part of what you get for your Social Security payments every year while you're working. It's instead allegedly voluntary, but no wise person in their mind would not have it. And it's paid for out of both premiums on the one side when you're elderly and about 75% of it is paid out of general revenues. That's the financing of it. Why would it be such a bad idea to have wealthier people pay more for this Part B insurance? Sounds plausible for the left. Sounds a little unlikely that right-wing people would be for it. So you have to ask yourself, what's going on there? Why would anybody sensible be for it? The answer is nobody would be, and here's why. The point about insurance is to pay for things in anticipation of possible trouble, not to pay for things when you're in trouble. That's the argument about patient cost sharing when you're sick. The point about prepayment through insurance is that you should put your money together in a pool such that when you have the problem that the money was to protect against, you draw from the pool. But you want the pool to be as wide as possible because you want to spread the cost as far as possible. Now, if you set the premium for people with incomes over $100,000 or $50,000 at one half of the expected outlays for Medicare people, for doctors, what would happen to the healthiest among the young elderly as they faced what to do with Medicare at age 66? Answer, they'd surely go together in a pool of healthy people and pay less. Instead of pooling everybody together, we'd start separating the pools. Dumb idea. Second dumb idea. If you believe we ought to pay more progressively for Medicare, fine, then use general revenues. That connects ability to pay with payment. There's no reason to think you want to stick it to particularly the elderly when they're higher income, because what that does is drive a wedge between us and them. And the whole point of Medicare was to treat people pretty much alike. Now, if you do want to make it proportional, one way you could express the premiums to Medicare would say 5% of Social Security checks go for Medicare. You know what that's called in Washington? That would be called a proportional tax. The other one, which is linking it to the incomes of people directly, is called means testing. It's called income-related premiums. That's the technobabble. But means testing has a long, long history of separating you from me, of people who get their means tested. Secondly, it's damn complicated and administratively cumbersome to do. When am I going to tell when you had $100,000? What happens if you had it last year but you don't have it this year? What kind of silly... We've got a perfectly straightforward way of prepaying for Medicare. Which is, most of it's on the hospital is paid for out of taxes that when you're working, the FICA taxes. And in the other one, we have a monthly premium and general revenues. I don't actually like the monthly premium. I'd be all for it's more straightforward, paying into it by 5% of your Social Security plus general revenues. Anyway, what's really going on here and why President Clinton should not be cooperating is that it's a Republican ruse to try to introduce the idea that Medicare is going to be for the low-income people and something else is going to be for the other people. And when you think about it in connection with the suggestion of medical savings account, which is even worse idea than this one, and when you put it together with the notion that the classic Republican view, which is the role of government, is to help people who really need it, not clusters of us, then you see the difference between social insurance and welfare.
Well, I can't leave that one alone. Why medical savings account is such a terrible idea?
It's the same point I made to you earlier about risk pools. If you say to somebody, you've got $4,200, which is the average expenditures for an elderly person. No, that's $4,200 was in 1994. The average of all the medical expenses of the elderly divided by the number of people. The 90% of the healthiest people among the elderly spent $1,200. The 10% of the least healthy spent $28,000 together. The average was $4,200. What will happen if you pull out the healthiest of the elderly who don't spend very much? What you'll do is simply make a big line of division between those who get sick and those who don't. Any risk pool like that means that the price for those most likely to sick goes up. This is an example where the reality of insurance, and I'm delighted you're asking me about this, the reality of insurance, which is almost never taught to American college students or high school students or ever talked about in any serious way, this is the reality. It's called adverse selection is the technical term. You select in a way that adversely affects the capacity to pool our circumstances.
We're talking to Professor Ted Marmor. He's a professor of public policy at Yale School of Management and author of Politics of Medicare. Now, what about in Medicare, the whole issue of home health care? Among his criticisms, that's among Trent Lott's criticisms of Clinton's plan, was that his plan would merely transfer the rapidly rising costs of home health care out of the trust fund and into the section of Medicare that relies directly on general Treasury revenues. What is Clinton proposing?
Well, Clinton is proposing a kind of an accounting adjustment so that this foolish thing called a trust fund seems actuarially balanced. I don't know whether your listeners want to go through this. Let me put it metaphorically first. Talking about either Medicare or Social Security in terms of trust funds is like confusing the thermometer with the cause of the weather. The trust funds simply register what it is that goes in and goes out. There's a Part A and there's a Part B program. It happens that Part A has a trust fund that is earmarked taxes and earmarked expenditures. Part B, on the other hand, because it's 75% general revenues and the other part premiums, is not accounted for in the same way, all right? Part B is growing rapidly, so is Part A. But Part A has got some cushion between funds going in and funds going out, even though the rate of increase is quite substantial in both. The idea of moving a program like home care from the Part B program to the Part A would be saying that we can account for it in a way that doesn't look as if we're in trouble. But the real question, if I told you that you were losing 10% of your coins in your left pocket and 10% of your coins in your right pocket, but you had more coins in your right pocket to begin with, and someone said, well, let's even it out. Let's take some of the coins in the right one and put it in the left one, and you kept on losing them at 10% per unit, would you feel better? No, you wouldn't. It's only if you were deluded by people like Trent Lott that you'd be. That's what I call the rhetoric of disinformation.
Who is behind the changes, whether they're Democrat or Republican? Because at this point, we're just talking about a matter of degree right now. It seems like there's an agreement on philosophy. It's just a matter of how much will we cut. Who are the lobbying forces
in Washington?
The
cutting business, I don't think, is the dividing point. That's my point. The cutting, a deficit hawk like me on Medicare is completely out of sync with Trent Lott and President Clinton on income-related premiums. So don't confuse those two. But you're right. They look as if they're coming close together, even though they fought like hell in the 96 election. That's because of, frankly, the effort to balance the budget. It's all preoccupied with that. Putting it under Part A gets it out of the deficit. That's the kind of accounting tricks it goes on. Mm-hmm. That's why we shouldn't have a balanced budget constitutional amendment, because it produces tricks like this. But who's behind it? Three groups. One, the crudest, the very crudest, is an insurance company that literally bought support to sponsor MSAs.
Medical Savings Account.
That is an insurance group that would gain directly. I think it's called Golden Rule. I think that's the outfit in mind. That's, in most sensible societies, the people involved in that would go to jail. But in this case, we call it the Golden Rule. That, I think, by the way, is the least important threat. I think MSAs will fall of their own weight as people come to experience what I'm talking about. The second group that's behind this, really, are the whole set of new institutions that grew up in the wake of the Clinton health care debacle, namely all these plans which want to get vouchers for Medicare so as to get regular monthly payments from this 34 million pool of Americans. And the great danger there is, unless we know how to administer vouchers for elderly persons in a program where you've got such an evenness about who uses care, we'll get the same kind of crazy risk selection that I was talking about before. Again, if you can get $4,200 and get lots of people who are healthy, you make a lot more money than you do by trying to do more efficiently the $28,000 per person care. So the groups that stand to gain here are the so-called health maintenance organizations. They are pushing the idea that managed care will somehow be the panacea for Medicare. And then the third group that's involved in pressing for this has nothing to do with medical care and everything to do with the passion about a balanced budget. Mm-hmm. They're the people saying they're not concerned about the cost of Medicare so much as they're concerned about the cost of Medicare to the federal budget.
Can you talk about this letter you wrote to the Washington Times?
Now, the Washington Times, which is hardly the outlet I normally would use for communicating my views, contacted me about commenting on the Social Security debate. They have a proposal, an answer in the affirmative, should Social Security be privatized by Forbes, and an answer in the negative by Tom Jones, the executive of TIA CREF.
And explain the connection between Medicare and Social Security.
Well, Medicare is financed, as I said, in Part A by Social Security taxes, so-called FICA taxes, and it was justified in the same way that retirement pensions were. We pool our money when we're working in order to draw it out when we're retired or when we're sick. and the ideology and the conception and the administration of it was all in HEW in 1965-66 when I was there. It's been split up since then into the Social Security Administration on the one side and HICFA, Healthcare Financing Agency, on the other. It's lost a little bit of its moorings. In 1965, every Social Security office had a Medicare desk, so that older people thought of Medicare and Social Security literally in the same terms. It was split off in 77 for allegedly administrative efficiency, a bit great mistake in my view. So the same thought about social insurance that goes into Social Security goes into Medicare and vice versa. And I am, and have been, as you probably know from reading other things, been a great critic of the what I call the hand-wringers about Social Security. The financing problem facing Social Security is modest. It's serious, modest, doable, manageable, if you want to do it.
How do you do it that you would like?
Well, just let me give you the scale of the problem. If you only think about pensions and raised Social Security taxes 1.2% on employers and 1.2% on employees, for the next 75 years, the expected balance between outflows and inflows would be there. In other words, any deficit for 75 years would disappear if you did that.
If you raise the tax.
By 1.2%.
And you think the American people would countenance that?
If they understood it, absolutely. Would you go to the wall on a 1.2% if you believed in the program? Actually, you could do lots of other things. Let me give you another example of the problem. If you adjusted the CPI, as many people suggest we do, by pushing it down by 1%.
The consumer price index.
The CPI, consumer price index. That would take care of 2/3 of the projected deficit in Social Security. Now, should we wring our hands about that? We might discuss it, but you wouldn't wring our hands about it. Anyway, Forbes opens his long essay by saying the most important question regarding Social Security reform is, who controls the money, you or the government? Well, our view is, to put the question that way is to commit the most extraordinary boner of 1997 so far. We regard him as a close contender to Ross Perot for the stupidest man in America in their use of personal money for run for the president. This is genuinely stupid. I mean, this would be like asking the head of a bordello to discuss chastity. The notion that we should turn to Steve Forbes to ask about who should control the money. After all, his publishing empire is devoted to the investment bankers who are just salivating the prospect of individual savings. Literally, good manners would suggest that you refrain from being pontifical about that, in addition to having a degree of income that makes him simply incapable of managing the economic security needs of most Americans. I think the greatest change in my lifetime since being a Harvard undergraduate in the late 1950s and now is the shamelessness of the wealthy in America, the boorishness of pronouncing their good fortune, or in his case, good inheritance, as grounds for thinking we ought to take them seriously.
Well, we do have to wrap up, but because this is such a complicated issue, what is the thought you'd like to leave our listeners with around the issue of Medicare and overall President Clinton's thrust toward poverty in America?
The main thought is the one I began with. Keep a sharp eye on the distinction between reducing the rate of increase in Medicare's expenditures to more tolerable levels. Keep that quite separate from changing the principles by which Medicare's benefits are distributed and how it's financed. And fight like crazy against the idea that Medicare is a program that ought to be financed in such a way to divide one elderly person from another.
Is there a number that people can call to perhaps get your articles or get your book, The Politics of Medicare?
Yes. They could call my office, 203-432-3238. And if they're interested in articles on Medicare or Social Security, or they could also write to me, Ted Marmor, at Yale School of Management. My last name, Marmor, and the Yale School of Management, New Haven, Connecticut, 06520. The book, The Politics of Medicare, is published by Aldine de Gruyter, which is in Hawthorne, New York. But any college...
Aldine, A-L-D.
A-L-D-I-N-E. Mm-hmm. Any bookstore could order it. It's just not, it is a college text, really. It's sold many copies, but it's done that way. But if anybody has any trouble, they'll let me know. I think the book that actually may be as helpful as anything in thinking about this, though, is a more, this All Politics of Medicare is now nearly 30 years old. It's about how we got it. I'm revising it. It'll be finished in the next month. But we wrote a book a few years ago, which I think is more generally important for your audience. And that's called America's Misunderstood Welfare State, which talks about Medicare, medical care, Social Security, and welfare, published by Basic Books, a paperback in 1992. And any bookstore would have that.
Well,
Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Errol also engineered today's show. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!